You are looking live at Moscow. This is the beautiful city, which is the capital of Russia. Hello again, everybody. We're going to be doing something a little different today, and we're excited to do this. We've got our mobile studio, and we're going to be coming to you from the center of Moscow. And you know what I think I want to do right now? I want to stop for just a moment, and I want to point some things out, because many of you I know nothing about this place that you see here behind me. By the way, neither did I just a few months ago. And of course, if you're from the United States, I know, or the UK or some other Western country, you probably think this is some type of scary, spooky, authoritarian state where people wrestle bears or something, right? I get it. So look, I'll just give you my impressions. Can Russians be a little distant sometimes as we look at some of these pictures here near the Kremlin Square? Yeah, they sure can, of course. But everywhere you go, if you were to come here at some point, you would find that people speak English and that they make you feel welcome. Signs are in English. The music that they play at the malls are in English. I find myself singing all the time. Same as department stores, in English. Children are taught English in the schools, so most of the people speak English in one way or another. As for how it compares to the place where you're probably watching us from right now, well, let me do this. Let me give you some points, and then you can draw your own comparison, all right? I'll go through some of the points. Homelessness, it hardly exists in any of the big cities here. Crime, not much to speak of. You don't feel it, you don't see it. Drug addiction, yeah, not a national problem like it is in my country. The economy, basically strong. People aren't wealthy by any stretch of the imagination, but they all seem to have paying jobs, live normal lives, take care of their families, have homes, see them out shopping in stores. The stores are filled with merchandise, despite all the sanctions. I know, I end up going shopping myself a lot. By the way, traffic here sucks, horrible, really bad, especially in Moscow. Maybe some of the worst anywhere. But you know what's really cool? Good and bad, right? It's a very walkable city. And the metro, which most people use, is arguably one of the best in the world. Clean, it's like a museum. Also, the city is designed to put people and families first. You see it in the parks, you see it in green spaces, the way the benches are laid out. It's all designed for families. So obvious. Oh, by the way, you see it in the government too. The policies that guarantee every worker by law 4 weeks of vacation. Try getting your boss to give you that in America. Medical services, free. Not when you turn 65, your whole life. Guaranteed by the government. Of course, you can upgrade if you want to pay for boutique services. Oh, and if you're a woman, you're guaranteed, again, by law, 140 days minimum of leave for maternity. 70 days before your baby's born, 70 days after your baby is born. Guaranteed. Then, of course, those women, they can get back to wrestling bears. Sorry. Look, I just thought you'd want to know because, you know, we learn in life that things are not always as they seem. And Russia, I have found this place that you look at here behind me with all the people walking around looking quite happy. Russia is a good example of that, that things are not always as they seem. Now, let's get back to the news. Let's do this. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. So, I guess we have to talk with the big news story out there. Just how many seemingly unprovoked attacks is Israel going to continue to perpetrate? The latest is really quite remarkable. You think about it, the ultra right-wing government of Bibi Netanyahu has now bombed its own people a lot. Lebanon, Yemen, Iran, and now Damascus. It acts like it's the cock of the walk, right? And it's putting the entire Middle East, maybe the whole world, on notice that they, Israel, and they alone call the shots in the region. They and they alone dictate policy. And they do it by force, by the way. And if you don't like it, they'll bomb you too, just as they did yesterday in Damascus.
شباب في عندنا قصف شباب قصف قصف يا شباب خذونا على الهواء
مهاجمة قوات
غارة جديدة الآن، غارة جديدة الآن،
غارة جديدة وائل، غارة جديدة وائل، غارة ثانية، غارات عنيفة جدا، أربع صواريخ.
It's unbelievable to watch stuff like that. I mean, it's almost like, I don't know, maybe we've become immune to it, maybe we shouldn't. But we do have to ask ourselves, right? Why is Israel bombing Syria? It says it wants to protect the minorities there. More on that in a minute. But the fact of the matter is, what Israel really wants to do is, it wants to dictate policy, direction, and the politics of Syria. It wants to control it. It's literally telling Syria's new government there where they can deploy their forces and where they can't deploy their forces. Imagine that. For example, it's telling them it is not allowed to send troops south of the capital without permission from Tel Aviv. See, what Israel really seems to be doing is trying to make sure that Syria remains weak and in crisis by turning minorities likely against the Jilani government. Israel says it's really doing it to protect the Druze because they're a minority group. In fact, here's Bibi Netanyahu talking about this very thing.
My Druze brothers, citizens of Israel, the situation in Soweda in southwestern Syria is extremely grave. The IDF is acting. The Air Force is acting. Other forces are acting. We are acting to save our Druze brothers and destroy the regime gangs.
Israel is protecting minorities. Let that sink in for just a moment. Think about it. Israel, a country that has killed 17,000 children and is starving and massacring its own minority group, the Palestinians. Israel, that Israel, wants to dictate rules to teach others how you are supposed to treat minorities. Again, let that sink in. You literally could not make up anything that sounds more ridiculously paradoxical than that, or at least I can't think of it. So the question you're also probably asking yourself is, how do they get away with something like this, right? Well, of course, in large measure, it's because of the United States, who's really their sugar daddy, and Donald Trump, speaking of sugar daddies. But still, why doesn't the rest of the Arab world, the Arab countries in the region, stand up and actually do something? There's a difference between doing and saying, right? Because they say a lot. They say and say and say and say. But they do very little. Short answers for that, by the way, are they are weak. They are defeated. Think about it. All the countries that have already been picked off before they got to Syria. Or they're simply just bought off, man. On behalf, by the West, by the way, at the behest of Israel. But there's something going on now that I need to tell you about. Something that just happened. This is brand new information. You may not have heard about this. There's something that's happened that might change that. For the first time, there's a group of countries that have come together to challenge Israel. It's called the Hague Group. It's this coalition of countries that's going to take on Israel. Interesting, too. It's starting in Colombia with a president there named Petro, who the United States hates, by the way. This thing is all over the news, this new Hague Group. And everybody's covering it. Here's their message.
Now that the economy revolves around genocide, there is no longer a good Israel and a bad Israel. We have to confront them. Whatever happens, I want to say this. Palestine will have written this tumultuous chapter, not as a footnote, but as agents of justice, standing against tyranny and neoliberal colonialism.
Our Hague group has to go further, because if not, the genocide is not going to stop. The barbarism will continue. What I want is a humanity of free beings everywhere on the planet. I think all of us do. So it is our turn. I end my statement by shouting,
Viva Palestina Libre!
So what are they going to do, right? Well, they're not just going to talk. That's beautiful, but everybody's heard words like that. What they're actually going to do is they say they're going to get a consortium of countries, like maybe as many as 30, 40 countries, to stop Israeli ships from entering their ports. stop them from being able to get any weapons or funding that they can use against the Palestinians. Interesting concept, action for the first time, which is obviously something that supersedes words, right? We're going to be talking about this because it's important and we want to know more. By the way, I should also mention to you that the U.S. State Department came out just today and said it's going to punish those sons of guns, just like it says it's going to punish BRICS or anybody else who dares to speak out against Israel. Fascinating. When we come back, I'm going to finally get a chance to talk to somebody I've only spoken to from afar quite a lot. He's an award-winning correspondent with a flair and a sense of curiosity like few others. He's tough, not afraid to mix it up, and he tells it like it is. He is senior RT correspondent Morad Gazdiev, who's going to join me today as our guest. You stay right there because we're going to be right back. So I want to start with something before we get started here. As I told you, I'm about to be talking to Morad Gazdiev. And in fact, let's see Morad while he's here. Good to see you, my friend. How are you?
Good, good.
I'm so excited to have you here.
Thank you, Rick.
I'm thinking about just bragging about you because, you know, there's people who walk, there's people who talk the talk, and there's people who walk the walk. You're a real war correspondent. You've been in Syria. You've been in Ukraine. You've literally filed stories while under fire. I've seen them.
Yep.
So you come here with real experience as a journalist. And I only say that because a lot of people call themselves journalists who aren't necessarily journalists, if you know what I mean.
No, I know what you mean.
So nice to see you.
Thank you, Rick.
You good?
It's good to be here.
I want to start by letting you listen to something, okay?
Yeah.
So this is Assad, I think, 2 or 3 years ago. And he was talking about the real pursuit of the plan that aimed to take out, as you know, Jeffrey Sachs has talked about this, that took out Afghanistan, then changed the regime in Iraq, and then changed the regime in Libya, and then changed the regime in Syria. And now they're planning on doing Iran and finishing up again and in Syria. But here he is. Listen to his words. I want to see how you what you say on the back end of this. Here it is. Go ahead and play that, Gene.
As for the scenarios that actually happened, the truth is that these scenarios were drawn up, as happened with Gaddafi or as happened with Saddam Hussein in Iraq, in order to create a state of fear. These scenarios were not just in our minds. We were fighting a battle with the Jews. The target was not Gaddafi, but Libya. The target was not Saddam Hussein, but Iraq. And now the target is not the president, Bashar al-Assad, it is Syria.
I find this fascinating because as an American, I was always told we have to go after Saddam Hussein. We have to go after Gaddafi. We have to go after Assad. Most Americans, we don't even know what countries those people represent. They personalized it. They made it about people, evil men. We got to get rid of those evil men. What he's saying is, and it just seems so obvious, I find this really interesting, maybe you don't, is what he's saying is, the whole time they could give a crap about us. What they wanted to was regime change in those countries. Whether we were the presidents or the rulers or anybody else would have been the rulers. Is he right?
Well, he's absolutely. The whole point of painting Assad or Saddam Hussein or whoever else as the bad guy is to be able to sell it to the American people. The American people don't want to sit there, not just the American people, the Russian people, the Ukrainian people, the Europeans. They go to work, you know, they slave away in a factory all day.
Yeah, yeah.
They want to come home, they want to switch on the television, and they want to hear good things. They don't want to think.
Yeah.
People want to relax, they want entertainment, they want an adventure from the comfort of their sofa at home. And you tell them, you know, American soldiers who you're paying for with your taxes are going to go and destroy this evil villain from the Marvel Universe.
Right.
And we're going to make the world a better place.
Yeah.
And people and children are going to be happy and they're going to thank you.
Saddam Hussein is going into hospitals and he's crushing the heads.
You can sell it to anyone.
Babies, yeah.
You can sell it to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
People will pay for it.
Speaking of pay, only because you're on this subject, I have to mention this. There was actually one of the top marketing groups in the United States of America that was paid hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars to create an advertising campaign to convince the American people that Saddam Hussein was going into Kuwait and taking babies out of incubators, throwing them on the floor, and then the soldiers were stepping on their heads. And they hired a young lady who wanted to be an actress to stand in front of Congress and say she was there and she saw it. Then we did an investigation later on, one of the few good things I did while I was at CNN, where we discovered that she actually worked for one of the diplomats in the Ukrainian government and was hired as an actress to put on that show, and it was all bullcrap. Isn't that amazing?
Well, it's
so sophisticated.
It's not, it isn't. Hundreds of thousands, it's nothing. Hundreds of millions, yeah, sure. Ukraine, billions spent, billions. And the stuff they came up with, yeah. You remember the headlines about in the first days of the war, Ukrainian grandmothers with jars of pickles shooting down Ukrainian drones. Mm. Or the scandal in Ukraine when it emerged that thousands of rape cases which their minister came up with were all fake and she was fired. But it did the damage.
Yeah.
I mean, it may sound stupid to you and me sitting here, you know, Jesus Christ, they hired this actress to go and act. But it is.
It sounds stupid to you. It doesn't sound stupid to me. And I'll tell you why it doesn't sound stupid to me. I was one of those stupid people. I'm sorry, but I hate to say it. I mean, I apologize to everybody listening to me right now. I was a correspondent at CNN. I was fed lines by the State Department, and I used to feed those lines to the American people. And it wasn't until I started questioning them and challenging them that I got fired, by the way, for doing so. But we basically are given the lines from the government that we have to put out there, and they're often Zionist lines and military contractor lines.
Well, what's in the interests of the United States State Department and U.S. national interests, CNN says.
Right.
Honestly, I mean, everyone understands. If you turn on CNN, you know that anyone who turns on CNN doesn't expect the correspondents or whoever else to be going against the interests of the United States. No one does.
But that's what you're supposed to do.
Really?
A journalist is supposed to ask the questions no matter where it leads them.
A journalist, yes.
Right.
Here, for example, you know, again, back to the actress that you cited, the damage has been done.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you, Rick, others, right, who go against the grain, go against the flow, expose these things. That's good, but the damage has been done. The American people, others, they've already seen her acting.
You can't unsee it. Right.
Yeah, you can't
put the toothpaste back in the tube.
And
exactly.
A very small majority are going to remember.
Well, and that's the problem with Ukraine. I mean, we start to see the American people coming around now. And I don't know how it's happening, but it's happening. Maybe it's because there's enough alternative media out there. Maybe it's because people are just getting angry. For the first time in my lifetime, I saw a poll a week and a half ago in the United States where the American people are siding more now with Palestinians than they are with Israel. I find that fascinating. Then again, America is a country where it doesn't matter what the people think. It only matters what the people who are paid think. And those are the people in Congress and in the Senate and who become part of the administration.
Are you still in touch with your colleagues from, you know, friends from CNN?
Of course.
What are they, are they feeling power draining way?
I think for the first time from most of the conversations that I have with them, they're starting to see that there is something very different that is going on. And I think a lot of them have really bought into, at least not the actions of Trump, but the messaging of Trump. But I think they continue doing what they're doing more right out of need. If you got a job at CNN, you're guaranteed at least $1 million a year, right? In the case of Anderson Cooper, $22, $25 million a year. It's a lot of money. So that money is being paid to you. Even though your audience is minuscule, you have the best commercials because those guys put those commercials there just for access. It's a funny system, the way it's working right now in the United States. It doesn't make much sense, but it is what it is. Let me ask you about Syria, by the way, because it's the big story today. What was your reaction yesterday when you turned on the TV and you saw those bombs hitting Damascus?
Do you know how many times I've been to that building?
No.
Every time you go to Syria as a journalist, this is for everyone, Russian, American, whoever else, you go to the Syrian Ministry of Defense, you get your papers.
Yeah.
Accreditation, you have permission to work there.
Yeah.
I even remember where, third floor in that building. Now, they were very different people. Back when I was there in Syria, there were Christians there, there were atheists in that building, there were Druze, there were Assyrians, absolutely everyone, all faiths, all denominations in that building. When that rocket or those bombs hit yesterday, there's only one category of people in there. Sunni Muslims from Syria, who are representatives of the victorious HTS, al-Nusra, or Jalani's flock. You know, this is the hardline jihadists. Only they were present there.
A guy who, by the way, we should mention to our audience, just in case they don't know, used to be a terrorist, but now he put on a suit.
The head of Al-Qaeda's cell in Syria. He started the whole shebang. And, you know, he came once very close to killing me, one of the suicide bombers.
Really?
In Aleppo in 2016.
Jalani did?
Yeah, I was in Aleppo at the time when the Battle of Aleppo was unfolding.
We were
in the city. And there's a dramatic video, essentially about 60 meters away from us, an APC, armored personnel carrier, huge thing, packed with explosives, tons of explosives, detonators, and everything's dust. So it's one of his boys, one of his.
You must hate this guy.
Well, you
know. Is that too strong a word?
Yeah, it's too strong a word. I don't hate. I don't hate. Nobody ordered me to go there.
Right.
You know, I was there voluntarily. There's a war raging. I don't understand the journalists that every single time they get into a situation, you know, what the military in the United States says, FUBA. When they put themselves in that situation and then they make a whole story, breaking news, we almost died.
Yeah, well, you're in a war zone.
You went there that's yourself.
That's exactly. I went to a hockey game and I saw a hockey game. Well, you're in a hockey stadium.
Precise.
Exactly.
Precise. Yeah, the story isn't that I almost died. The story is that a whole host of soldiers, of civilians who were trying to flee, trying to get away, women running, clutching their children, trying to get away from his suicide bombers, the president of Syria now. That's the story.
Assad said just a moment ago in that soundbite I played for you that he's no longer there because somebody decided to change the regime in his country. And is he right? Was it as simple as just somebody at some point, most likely Netanyahu, according to Jeffrey Sachs, with the help of Washington, decided that we needed to change the regime in Syria and in Afghanistan and in Iraq and in Libya?
Well, essentially, that is what happened. All of these countries, the United States, had an integral, essential role in helping topple these countries, whether it's by providing weapons, as in Syria.
But my question is, did they do it as a plan? Did they go in? Because, you know, revolutions happen.
Rick, we can sit here and we don't have the papers. Nobody's going to give us, you know, those papers. Those papers are in military bases and are guarded by armies.
Let's do this then. Let's look at motive. The motive would be for Netanyahu to try and control the Middle East by getting rid of those powerful forces in those powerful countries, or used to be powerful forces in powerful countries. They're a mess.
Do you know what I'd say about those countries that you mentioned? Libya, Iraq, Iran, there was an attempt. Syria. These nations were ruled by men who couldn't give less what the rest of the world thought about them. Right? They weren't under control.
He who can't be controlled must be removed.
They weren't under control.
Right.
You couldn't come in, a U.S. ambassador couldn't come in and say, look, buddy, this is in the interest of the United States. It's got to be done, the good way or the bad way, which is what they've done to Europe. Which is what they've done to Europe, the European Union. Destroyed its industry. Destroyed future.
So what
growth.
You are describing is submissiveness.
Essentially. These countries weren't submissive. Now, I wanna make very clear that this is in no way, you know, am I saying Saddam Hussein was the good guy?
No, of course.
That his hands
but
were
who
clean.
Is?
Who is? It's a different
you
question.
Know? I mean, what did Trump do with Epstein's girlfriends? I mean, I don't know. How old were they? There's a lot of tape out there.
What
and a lot
circus.
Of,
I mean, what a circus.
I'm sorry, but that thing looks worse every single day.
Well, he ran a campaign promising the American people you're going to see these names.
Yeah.
And now he says, don't talk about it.
There's videotape out there now of him with two young ladies with their breasts out.
I am sure that there's much more than one videotape.
It's like getting to be quite a mess.
These parties went on for years.
And you know, it's going back to, now we'll talk about things I know about a lot, which because I've followed the politics in America, I'm seeing for the very first time, Morad, in my country, because of what is going on in Ukraine, and the American people are really tired of those $300 billion they could have used with their children or their grandchildren. Instead, some small comedian is getting all of that money and going around asking for more now. They're also angry about there's a possibility there may be 400,000 dead Palestinians when they remove all that rubble. And Americans are starting to get that picture. And they watch Bibi Netanyahu come to their country and order their politicians around like they're slaves or something. And now along comes this Epstein thing on top of that. We were promised transparencies as the voters of America by this new administration. And instead, Americans feel like they're getting the middle finger. And you know what? There's a move afoot in America because of this. I would even say it's nearing kind of an American perestroika or an American glasnost at this point. I don't know if it'll get that far, but people are pissed. They really are.
Over the years, you as an American, you haven't experienced this on the receiving end, but Americans have always loved to say, at least we come from a free country. They loved it. They loved it. The Europeans did to a certain extent as well. But, you know, when you were out in the bar, you meet someone, you're getting drunk and whatever.
Right.
And they always throw it at you. It may not be even intentional.
Something you Russians need to understand.
Yeah,
you.
And you're sitting there. You're thinking, try it now. Try it.
Right.
Come tell me that you come from a free country.
Stand up in America right now and criticize the state of Israel and see what happens to you.
Precisely.
Your ass will be in jail.
Precisely.
Because it is. A lot of people are going
to
jail.
Even Israel aside, I mean, the Israel thing has been going on for how many decades where you can't reasonably criticize Israel and expect your career to go on.
But you know what's weird? Here's what's so weird. And I tell people this all the time. They don't believe me. If you're an American journalist or even just an American citizen or an advocate of some kind, you can more safely criticize your own country than you can Israel.
Yeah.
You can criticize the Republicans, you can criticize Democrats, you can criticize the president, you can do it out loud.
It's insane.
But if you criticize Israel, they can put you in jail.
Insane.
They'll fire you, you'll lose your government, you'll lose your job, you'll lose your business. It's crazy.
You know what shocked me most was how they went after the students.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, it's students who have to do it's part of being a teenager, an adolescent. You get involved in causes, you gain life experience, and they've started censorship. They've started expelling students for doing what students have always done, getting involved. It's crazy.
It's funny because I'm looking at these people behind me right now. Look at this. These are the people of Moscow. I jog here every once in a while, and I hang out around these people, and I stop in the cafes, and I get a chance to talk to them and meet with some of them. And the weird thing that I tell my friends back home, I was talking to Colonel McGregor last night, and he was asking me what they're like and everything. I said, I got to tell you. You know how we're always talking about the things that we want in America? We want to get rid of our drug problem, and we want to get rid of the homelessness, and we want to get rid of, all the crime problems, and we want to get back to being family-oriented, and we want people to be, walking on the streets and feeling safe and everything. I just described to you Moscow. So in some weird ways, look, this place is not perfect either. No place is. It's got its issues also. But generally speaking, I feel like this place is in many ways what America keeps saying it wants to be. That's weird.
It is. It's every country in the world. I've been to 72 countries as part of my work, my reporting. Eventually, you arrive at the conclusion that everyone's identical.
Yeah, exactly.
Ultimately,
we all want the same stuff.
Identical. Yeah. It isn't even, but we want to express ourselves the same way. But just because of where, the good Lord or design or fate put us on this world, where it drew our borders, that is the difference between us.
But, the one thing that, damn it to hell, we need to figure out a way to do is better understand other people's stories.
It isn't going to happen. It isn't going to happen.
But why are we so, I don't want people to understand the imperial years of Russia and what happened with Nikita Khrushchev and Brezhnev and everybody else who was here, or any of those things. Just can you at least, when Putin gives a news conference, take a couple of notes? Can you play 20 seconds of him on the news so American people can see him other than without a shirt on Saturday Night Live? Because if we don't understand what the origins are of what started or manifested whatever the problems are here, how the hell can we say that we either care about them or can help solve them?
Rick, it isn't going to happen, unfortunately.
Oh, ye of little faith.
Due to scarcity. Oh, yeah. You know, maybe I'm a cynic.
You are a cynic.
After everywhere I've been.
That's the problem with being a war correspondent.
But ultimately, if you have this you know, commune where everybody understands everyone, where everyone's happy, where everyone listens to each other, all it'll take is one Jalani al-Shara,
right,
just one, to come in and go, oh, look at this. These guys are
all
idiots with their pants down. Yeah, yeah. Boys, let's get to it. It's going to happen.
Yeah.
It's going to happen.
You make me sound like I'm some yellow-bellied fool.
Ultimately,
I'm here because I want to be able to communicate the stories that nobody seems to want to know.
That's our job.
Yeah.
That's our job.
Right.
Despite the inevitability that conflict will continue.
You're saying I'm wasting my time?
Wasting your time?
Yeah.
No. It's because of people like you have gone against the flow, against the grain, risked everything themselves.
Yeah, no, you're right.
Risked everything themselves, their future, their money, a lot of money.
Oh, my God.
A lot of money.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, what the U.S. government could do if they just decided, that's it, we're going into your...
That is scary. Without people like you, Rick, I'm not kissing your ass.
Yeah.
But without others who are prepared to give up what is theirs, or their future, or their, you know, lavish lifestyle, and do what they believe is the right thing, we would all live in essentially Syria.
Yeah, yeah.
That is the truth.
Truth matters.
Yeah, truth matters. Yeah.
And guys like you, I mean, hell, you've put your life on the line for that truth, so it's important to be able to tell, you know, the stories that matter. What do you think? I mentioned, I don't know if you heard, did you hear my intro?
Yeah.
In my intro, I said, and I talked about the fact that Israel right now is the, you know, cock of the walk. They are truly just pounding their chests and going around the world saying, we dictate what you can and can't do. And we're going to continue to do this. And anybody who dares defy us will get bombed as well. It's a hell of a thing, isn't it? I read it right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
It's crazy. They're this big.
Yeah, no one can stop them.
What the hell?
No one can stop them. The United States is prepared to sacrifice its own national security, its own interests, money. This is, you know, the trillions that they are borrowing to finance Ukraine, to finance Israel. Israel more, I believe, to a tune of much more money nowadays, especially. But ultimately, if you are in the position where you can get away with doing all of this, you have no conscience, no morals.
Mm-hmm.
You believe Israel, you know, the Jews are the God's chosen people, and everyone else is you know, riffraff.
Mm.
Then you would. Everybody would act in the way that Israel is acting. Now, it must be borne in mind that Israeli society is absolutely paranoid. They are paranoid.
They're leaving.
They're
leaving.
Some are leaving.
Yeah.
Some are leaving.
Yeah, they've lost population.
Especially those who are staying. They believe everyone is out to get them.
Yeah.
And the irony here is everything that they do ultimately results in everybody actually being out to get them.
Yeah, exactly.
Imagine the United States drops its support tomorrow. God forbid there's a civil war or whatever else. You know, people get tired of files and videos getting misplaced in the United States, and Israel is left without support, without a constant stream of munitions, rockets, money, interceptors, everything streaming in. What do you think all the Arab countries around them are going to do?
Well, those Arab countries right now, I was talking to, I went over to the embassy yesterday, spent some time with the Israeli ambassador, the Iranian ambassador. And we talked a little bit about the situation with Israel. And, you know, he seemed to be intimating to me that he's very disappointed with his Arab partners in the world. He thinks they're generally, I can't remember the exact word he used, but it sounded an awful lot like weak. Why is that? Why Israel is this big? I mean, you've got all of these huge nations with so much money, enough money to buy the biggest military from China and Russia in the world, and they just sit back and go, yeah, that's really bad. We're against what Israel is doing. It's really bad. Okay, next.
Right? Do you know how many houses the Saud family, have in London, in Miami, where all their kids, the King of Jordan, their properties, they're all in London, in Miami, in sunny places, good places, with expensive stores. They're there. If they so much as look at the United States or Israel wrong, they know very well that their heads are going to roll. Their wallets are done. And they will be crucified by the United States, by its partners, at the behest of Israel.
Is that what the Arab Street was really about when it first started?
Well, of course, you mentioned, it all goes back to what you said about the countries that they bombed, the countries, the leaders of which didn't have their kids in London and in Miami and in Washington and wherever else.
Gosh.
You know, there's a leash on Saudi Arabia.
That's such a good point.
Precisely. There's a leash on Egypt, the money that the United States gives them.
Yeah.
There's a leash on Dubai.
Jordan.
On United Arab Emirates. Jordan.
Yes.
Absolutely. These countries depend on the West for goodwill, for aid, for money, for protection.
So it's almost like, how dare you not depend on us?
Precisely.
And if you don't depend on us, we will ruin you.
Precisely.
What they're doing.
And while these leaders, who are essentially leashed by the United States, are in power.
Submissive.
Israel has nothing to fear. Yeah. Nothing to fear.
Wow. What does that lead to? I wonder. This is why we
it
get
can't
to...
last.
Well, yeah, this is why... Let's get to the next version of this conversation where you and I need to go. I like the way we're doing this because we're actually going through a progression of... We've examined the problem. We've understood the problem. We've seen where it was, seen where it is, and now where does it go? Here's where I think it goes. You tell me. I think this thing that I just reported to our viewers about that's taking place in Colombia is just the tip of the spear. I mean, the idea that 30 countries, including Colombia of all countries, is getting together now with China and several other countries. I'm not sure if Russia's throwing their hat into that, but I'm sure they will at some point, saying, yeah, we're willing to get together to actually do something to stop what's happening in the world. In much the same way that BRICS apparently wants to do it. I know it's in its formative stages still, but is that the beginning of what can maybe be a counterbalance to that hegemony that we often talk about?
Well, I believe that the United States over the decades has neutered many counterbalances, things that could blossom into a threat or a counterbalance again. But I believe the United States, which remains incredibly powerful and with the financial demise, or demise is a strong word, with misfortune in Europe, financial misfortune, billionaires fleeing to the United States with their money, with their, you know, corporations, with their offices and headquarters away from European taxation, away from decline in European industry.
Yeah.
Ultimately, I believe the United States is even more powerful now than it was before. Ergo, here's the question. Who is going to come out first? Is it going to be Colombia? Is it going to be China and say to the United States, to their face, look, we're going to stand up to you. And laugh in their faces.
Yeah.
They're going to laugh in their faces.
Yeah.
And the other way, of course.
Well, in the case of China, by the way, there's this relationship, economic relationship between the United States and China, which makes neither of them able to make a move without ruining its own economy.
Precisely. And
because of debt.
Unlike some politicians in the United States, in China, they're very wise, I've got to say. They will keep their mouth shut. They won't say a thing.
Yeah.
They may hate you. They may despise you. They may want you dead. But they'll smile. They won't say a thing until they feel comfortable.
You know what's weird is this place, Russia. The interesting thing about Russia from a totally geopolitical standpoint is, unlike China, it does not have that type of relationship with the United States where it needs the United States to survive.
No, it doesn't.
In fact, it seems to be saying and proving to the world, we're fine without you. You want to join? Great. If not, we've got other friends.
Yeah, well, Russia's...
You don't have to come to the
Russia's
party.
Trade with the United States is, I believe, less than $1 billion.
Yeah, it's nothing.
It's nothing.
Yeah,
it's change
right.
in the grand scheme of things.
It seems to me Russia went out of its way because it wanted to be a friend of the United States and join it as an entity in G20 and G7 and NATO and all these places, actually said, let us be a part of this, please. And the United States basically just kind of took a dump on them. That seems to be what happened.
Do you remember what you told me, that the people here, you know, you spend some time here, and they're the same. They're the same as in the United States.
Yeah.
They're the same
people. Well, they even look the same, dress the same.
Yeah.
You'd think you're at the mall in Washington, D.C. looking around here.
A little thinner, maybe. Just a joke.
We're kidding, America.
Yeah,
we're not kidding. Fat.
But the thing
yes,
is...
Yes, you are.
And this isn't just my experience. This is experience.
By the way, I've lost a little weight since I've been here.
Oh, nice.
Looking good.
Nice. Yeah,
thank you.
Now, don't give my wife any idea. She's been at me for the extra pounds. But I just want to finish the thought that, again, all the countries I've been to, all the expats and the people who, Russians who've lived in the United States returned, or Americans who lived in the United States came to Russia. And these are people who have been to other countries. There are very few peoples in this world, nations in this world, as similar psychologically as Russians and Americans.
Yeah.
There are very few people in the world that are as similar.
You know,
the same
design.
You're right.
Yeah, right. I see it when I talk to the taxi, my driver,
They are both
the same thing.
Precisely.
And some of it's not good, by the way.
It
makes like my dad when I had to say, Dad, don't say that in public.
But neither these people, nor, you know, your friends or whoever else in New York, in San Francisco, they are unafraid to come up to your face and go, you know, I don't like this. This doesn't suit me.
Right.
You know, we've got to change things. They are both a strong peoples, an expressive, you know, peoples. Yeah. So certainly, in that respect, the United States, Americans and Russians are the same freaking people.
You know, I get a sense here when I talk to people that they're angry with Putin. They want him to hurry up and end this damn thing, and they're sick and tired of it. It's like they almost think. I hear more people criticize him for putting up with too much crap, especially at the time, like when they hit the railroads and stuff like that. They were like, okay, that's it. Go in there and, you know, nuke them, finish them. Of course, you know, the way people talk, same way people talk
but
in America.
This is the difference between Russia and America, where in the United States, knee-jerk reactions are expected.
Yeah.
You know, the people demand, they want knee-jerk reactions. They want poo, 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 poo. In Russia, you know,
the
Ukrainians attacked an airfield, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
They destroyed several strategic bombers. There's a big damage, a lot of money, right?
And Lavrov comes out and says, well, here's the... due to the consideration of the damage that
was
done...
Precisely.
Right?
Precisely. The people, these people, they want blood.
Yeah.
They want blood. They want Kiev to burn. They want the Ukrainian parliament destroyed. Russia can do it. It can destroy every single political landmark in Ukraine within a week.
Russia's been extremely patient.
Here's what Lavrov and Putin in there, when they get together, you know, I've worked with them for many years now.
Yeah.
They sit down, they grab the a piece of paper, and they say, what do we gain?
Right.
How does this suit or serve the interests of the Russian Federation? Long-term interests. Yeah, the people will be happy. They'll switch on TV tomorrow in the morning.
Right.
They'll see the Ukrainian parliament, presidential palace, Zelensky's, you know, dacha burning. What have we gained? These missiles cost money.
But they don't even do an Erdogan. Because Erdogan, for example, will give this Turkey's president, for those of you who can't follow this, or I'm sure most of you do if you're watching our show. Erdogan gives a speech every Tuesday where he says the most horrible, heinous things about Bibi Netanyahu, and talks about how the Arabs are going to take over the world, and it's hell and brimstone, and then he doesn't do a damn thing.
Yeah.
You don't. Putin doesn't even do that. He speaks in like a low voice.
They've eschewed the whole spectacle. You know, this isn't a show. This isn't in the United States.
That's interesting. You know, that's an interesting observation.
Well, it's driven in the United States, perhaps by the electoral cycle.
Exactly.
Putin is so far ahead of any possible competition. He doesn't need to come out and give the Russian people a show that, you know, they can sit down after work and watch.
And to his credit, by the way, you're right. There's no question, and I think most Americans are now starting to recognize that some of the horrible things we have put Russia through, Russia has been extremely patient and forgiving about. The other thing, though, with Putin I find interesting is I think most people, while they're not completely satisfied because everybody still wants more money and less inflation and everything else, no matter where you are, there is a general sense that he has dealt with taking Russians from the lean years, right, post-Soviet, et cetera, through the kleptocracy years, where some of the oligarchs were stealing left and right, to where it is now, where it's a heck of a lot better.
Rick,
things are under
you
control.
You weren't here 20 years ago. 20 years ago, you didn't see all of this crumbling.
Are you old enough to remember that?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
I was born in 87.
What was that like?
I was about 7, 8 when bandits, organized crime, Russian mafia, and these aren't the, you know, the sort of people you see on television or Hollywood movies. Those are nice guys.
Yeah.
The worst Russian mobster you see in an American movie, it has nothing
compared to these.
Nothing on the people that ruled this city and this country 25 years ago. And every single Russian
out of control.
It was insane.
Really?
I was sent out of the country at 7 years of age because mobsters told my mother that they would have my head, they would cut my head off if she didn't give up her business.
Wow.
And seven, I left the country.
So
alone,
there was like a protection, right?
Alone.
Yeah.
The entire country, the entire people in the West, in Europe, in America, where even in Asia, they look at Putin's poll numbers, and why do Russians keep supporting him?
85%.
He ended it.
He ended it, right.
He ended it.
Yeah.
People could, I wasn't allowed outside alone whenever I came back to Russia, to Moscow.
And now all you see is people outside.
Exactly, alone. Until I was 16.
I was sitting with one of our colleagues recently, Saskia.
Yeah.
We were having lunch over in, what's it called? The Patriots Pond, how do you say that? Patriarch Pond. Right, yeah. Beautiful place.
Nice.
A lot
place.
Of fun. And we were sitting there, and she walked away, and she left her purse sitting on top of the table. And I said, what are you doing? She goes, nobody's going to touch it. I said, really? I said, we're in a public place. People are walking around. In America, somebody would grab it and be gone in a minute, or in most other places. She goes, no. If somebody did that, the other people would stand up, chase him, and kick his ass.
Yeah.
And it's not about autocracy. No. It's just that it just doesn't happen here.
No, it can.
Damn. Of course it can.
It can.
I'm not saying it's perfect.
You get to Japan, you leave.
But I guarantee you, it'll be gone in 2 minutes in Rio de Janeiro.
No.
2 minutes, did I say? 20 seconds.
Things have changed. People are no longer, as they were 20 years ago, desperate. If you aren't desperate, you don't steal a wallet. You don't steal a phone that you can pawn for $15. They're useless nowadays.
So your point is, Russians are not wealthy people. Nobody's walking around with Rolexes and stuff. Some are, but, you know. But generally speaking...
Yeah, in Moscow, a lot.
Right.
But, a lot.
But the average working stiff Russian, like to say, is a person who's generally satisfied with their lives.
Yeah.
Has their home and their wife and their children, and they're living a generally satisfactory life.
Russians value, above all else, stability. Right. This is a troubled land, right?
Was.
Well, this prosperity that Russia enjoys is only 20 years old. People still aren't used to it. The entirety of Russia's history has been turbulence.
You know what's
from
weird?
From Mongols to Napoleon, Hitler, the revolution.
And out of bad stuff always comes good stuff. I was having a conversation with Solyonov, the finance minister, recently on my show. Interesting guy. Real stiff-lipped guy at first, and then like everybody else, like most people and most Russians, you know, he became very friendly, and we had a wonderful conversation. And when I asked him about the fact that, how have you handled this economy, man? given the horrible sanctions and the horrible things that have been thrown at you. He said it's actually been a benefit in many ways. They've increased manufacturing. They've learned to do things they usually depended on the West to do for them, product-wise. And they have found new partners to do business with that they never would have looked for had they not been forced into that situation. I thought that was very telling in many ways.
Well, look, before the war in Ukraine, there was no reason to build a factory that produces a certain type of plastic bottles, for example. You could always just import them from Europe. It costs money to get a factory going. Yeah. You know, and why even build it if everyone's just going to buy from Europe? The European Union, and this is part of their knee-jerk reaction. You know, they could have continued to trade with Russia and given all profits to Ukraine.
Right.
Yeah, that would have been the pragmatic thing to do.
But then they wouldn't be punishing Russia.
But yeah.
Which they seem to be hell-bent on for some reason.
Well, they're punishing themselves.
Now they are punishing themselves. Yeah, now they are.
Because now nobody's buying from there. You know, the plastic bottles we spoke about.
Yeah.
From there.
Russia's GDP growth is 3.7, and apparently Germany's is negative 0.2.
Precisely.
Hell.
Europe simply can't have a future if it pretends that half of geographic Europe has just disappeared.
Huh.
This was their biggest market, local market. The biggest car market in Europe for German cars was Russia.
That's crazy.
Was Russia.
Yeah.
Their energy all came from Russia. The cheapest energy in the world.
And they're so stupid. I talk to drivers here, and I ask them about these Chinese cars, and they tell me, don't like them. I said, why? I go, we miss the American cars. They're better cars. We don't like the Chinese cars. I'm saying, well, guess what? You're going to be stuck with the Chinese cars for a while, and eventually you'll learn to love them as well. But the funny thing is,
the Chinese will catch up.
The Chinese will catch up. The funny thing is that here you have people telling me, we want your products, but they don't want to sell them to us. Isn't that crazy?
It's insane. It's insane. They're facing recession, and they're just pretending that their biggest market no longer exists. European companies can no longer fly their planes over Russia because they blocked Russian planes from flying over their countries. And now they're complaining that the Chinese airlines have a huge business advantage because they don't have to fly halfway across the world to ferry Europeans to and from Asia. I mean, it's essentially just shooting yourself in the foot, not once, not twice, but for 3 years incessantly. It's no pragmatism, no wisdom. I don't understand what is going on in Europe, and, you know, it is beyond me.
We're about out of time, my friend, but, you know, I was just sitting here wondering why you're so shy.
Shy? That's a first.
You know, some people like to say that I have kind of a big personality when I go on TV, and I do because I just love communicating ideas. I think I've met my match. It's wonderful having a conversation with you. You've got a great personality. You're a smart guy.
Honest
and you're
mind.
Brave, man. You're a courageous dude. So I appreciate it, really. So, hey, and here, first time you and I are actually working side by side.
Yeah, like first time.
We've done it before on TV.
But they let me out of the wardrobe.
Back in the cage. Take care again, my friend.
Cheers,
we'll see
Rick.
You. And that's it for us. Thank you so much for being with us. I really want to thank Morad for what is a delightful conversation, a real, you know, gutty conversation. Remember to follow me on my podcast. It's called Journalistically Speaking. You can find it on YouTube. Tens of thousands of people are joining, and that's really nice. Hundreds of thousands of people are watching. I just got something from Google saying, you just hit 1 million. That's nice to see. Also, we can have a conversation on X. I'm at Rick Sanchez TV. I'll be looking for you there. And I thank you so much for sharing so much of your time with us. We'll catch you next time.